Thank you so much, Monica. Hey guys, I'm Dheeraj and welcome back to the Rundown this week. I haven't been able to do a live show in a couple of weeks, so it feels really good to be back finally. And a lot has happened since last week. There's a lot to talk about. I might delve into some topics that are kind of unfamiliar with you guys probably, but that's okay. Everybody can learn to love different kinds of sports just like I have. I mean, I'm into baseball now, which is never something I thought I'd be into, but I don't know, I just love it. So, I'm really looking forward to this. And yeah, let's have a great show. So today I'm going to be talking about essentially four central things. So firstly, we're going to be having some NBA talk. Some things have happened in terms of teams going on runs. The Knicks, the Celtics have been on good runs in the past couple of weeks. I think the Knicks are like eight unbeaten right now, which is great. And then obviously we need to talk about Steph Curry, who's on an insane run, like just incredible over the past 10 to 12 games. This month he's been outstanding. And I think that eventually will lead me to, my top five MVP candidates right now. I think it's a really tight race. It's not definitive at all. That's the one thing that is definitive, the fact that it's not definitive. I think there are a lot of candidates for the award, and I'm going to be essentially talking about my top five candidates. And then that's NBA talk. Then I'm going to be moving on to something that's a little unfamiliar, and I'm going to be talking about one of my favorite sports, which is association football, what you would call soccer. Excuse me if I don't call it soccer. I just can't bring myself to do that because I've been calling it football my whole life. I call both association football and American football football, so just kind of, use clues to figure out which one I'm talking about at what point in time. So, I mean, look, there's been a lot of controversy in the football world over the past 3 to 4 days. 3 to 4 days, I think most people, even if you don't necessarily follow association football, you're familiar with the whole European Super League controversy that's kind of taken over social media spaces because so many people do care about it. And I just want to be talking about that for a bit. As a fan of a team that, did enroll to take part in the European Super League, that is Manchester United. That's my team. Love them to death. But the European Super League seriously had me considering whether, I wanted to support them anymore. And I'm just going to be talking about the issues with that, why so many people were against it, and how the problem isn't necessarily going away just because the league was kind of called off, or because most teams withdrew from the league. The problem isn't going away, and I'll be talking about that for a bit. Then I'll be doing some talking about baseball for a bit. I'm essentially just going to be freestyling that. Let's see what happens. A lot has happened, in the last couple of weeks. You've seen Carlos Rodon throw a no-hitter. I believe I talked about that last week a little bit. That was actually while I was recording last week's radio show. I think I was talking about Rodon throwing the no-hitter, which was just incredible. As a White Sox fan myself, I was really happy about that. And then, you've seen the Athletics. The Oakland A's are on an 11-game win streak right now. The Red Sox are on a 10-game win streak. The Yankees aren't doing too well right now. But the Yankees were on a 10-game win streak, actually, before the White Sox beat them twice on the same day. Sorry, the Red Sox, not the Yankees. I keep confusing the two. No, but the Red Sox were on a good streak. The Yankees aren't doing well at all. So what's up with that? And then, of course, you have the Padres, both in the same division, two of the World Series favorites. So, there's quite a bit to talk about when it comes to baseball. And then, finally, I'm going to be talking about the NFL. I wanted to talk a bit about the Eagles because there's been some talk about Jalen Hurts. Their coach, Nick Sirianni, had some very interesting things to say. I'll be delving into that for a bit. And then I wanted to take some time to talk about my top eight non-quarterback prospects in this year's draft. And I don't believe these players get the shine that they deserve. So that's why I wanted to, be talking about them as like, the top eight non-quarterback prospects in this draft. Because look, this is a quarterback heavy draft. There are probably going to be five QBs taken in the first 10 to 15 picks at max. So obviously very quarterback centric this draft, but there are still a lot of talented players outside of that top five. The draft is in exactly 1 week. Next week, I'll probably be taking the whole show to do a full mock draft. Just what I believe is going to happen, not what I think should happen. Those are two very different things. I think I've talked about this before. So I'll be taking the time to do that next week. So yeah, that's today's, I mean, that's going to be today's show, and I hope you enjoy. So talking about the NBA for a bit, you know, let's talk about Steph Curry. Look, Steph Curry came into the league in 2009 as the number 7 pick in the draft to the Warriors. And you know, he went to Davidson College, which is this, you know, fairly unknown, not as relevant. It's not a big school. It's like a mid-major in North Carolina. He went to Davidson, and then he led them on a magical Sweet 16 run, I believe, in the 2010 NCAA tournament, in the 2009 NCAA tournament. And that kind of catapulted him up, you know, up the draft stocks. And his dad, of course, Del Curry, played for the Charlotte Hornets and the Raptors for a long time. One of the best shooters of his era. I guess I kind of, I guess it's in his blood. It's in the Curry's blood, isn't it? But you know, Steph Curry was drafted. He was pretty, I guess he was seen as too small to play, you know, point guard in a league as physical as the NBA. And you know, the NBA isn't as physical as it used to be, but it still is quite physical. And Steph Curry was seen as, he wasn't a good defender when he came into the league, and he definitely hadn't filled out his frame. I think he was like 6'1" or 6'2" when he came into the league. He's 6'3" now, but he's definitely stronger. He's definitely stronger now than he was before. So, you know, Steph Curry, he's really filled out in terms of his body type. And look, it took him time to develop. I think he made his first All-Star game in 2014, if I'm not wrong. But then, you know, his stock really took off. And Steph Curry, in the last 5 to 6 years, has been one of those players who's changed basketball. He's one of the, probably after Wilt Chamberlain, I don't think any player has influenced basketball in terms of the way the game is played as much as Steph Curry has. You know, with you know, Wilt and Kareem, it was about, you know, maybe some of them had them abolishing dunking for a short period of time because they were so dominant, or changing the way free throws worked, things of that nature. But Steph Curry has come in, and he's been such a dominant player at the guard position in terms of his shooting, his playmaking. And he's evolved defensively as well. But look, this is the best shooter we've ever seen in NBA history. This is the best shooter in NBA history. There's no doubt about it. And he's changed the game because of the way he's just so willing to chuck up 3-pointers and the frequency at which they go in. And I use chuck up as like, not as a derogatory term, because when he shoots, his form is so quick and accurate that it just looks like he's chucking it up, but it goes in more often than almost any other player in the NBA. You know, he's one of the most accurate shooters, and that's both off the dribble, that's catch and shoot, that's off screens, from the corner, from the wing, from the top of the key. You know, he's a great shooter from everywhere, from 3-point range, and he can hit shots from 30 feet, 35 feet, even 40 feet. Like, he has limitless range, and he essentially changed the game, right? So Steph Curry changed the game and won 3 championships in the mid 2010s with the Warriors. You know. The first year, they obviously beat LeBron and the Cavs thrice. The first year, he had Klay and Draymond, and then they lost in 7 to the Cavs, you know, when the Cavs came back from being 3-1 down in the finals. And then in 2017 and 18, I think they lost like one game in the final collectively. They won 4-1 and 4-0, if I'm not wrong. So, look, this is the kind of player that's revolutionized the game. But after the 2019 finals against the Raptors, where, you know, Klay Thompson was injured and KD was injured, and you know, Draymond wasn't at full strength either, and it was just essentially Steph against, you know, this whole Raptors team. That was actually a really good team, you know, Kyle Lowry, Kawhi Leonard, and look, Kawhi is a better player than Steph. I think we all know that in terms of like holistically speaking, both on the offensive and defensive end ends of the floor, he's a better player than Steph. And he also had the supporting cast to beat the Warriors, who were already like so drained in terms of missing players from injury. So I think that was actually probably an impressive finals performance. The fact that he took, you know, those Raptors to 6 games practically on his own, I think that was very impressive, because he's, you know, this knock on Steph Curry is that he's always been surrounded by superior talent. Obviously, the likes of Klay and Draymond and Iguodala. Kevin Durant, obviously. So he's obviously surrounded by superior talent. But I think now we're getting to see what Steph Curry truly can do when he's attempting to carry a team on his own. And look, I've doubted Steph Curry a lot. I'm not gonna deny it. excuse me. I still don't think I've seen Steph Curry really perform in the in clutch periods of time as well as I wanted to in terms of like the finals and the playoffs and playing well at the end of games and in important games. I haven't seen him perform as well as I wanted to declare him maybe the best point guard ever. I think he's definitely second right now behind Magic. Magic Johnson, who's obviously the best point guard ever, greatest point guard ever. But I haven't seen enough from Steph in the clutch to kind of define him as or put him above Magic. But now, I mean, I think we've all started to see signs of that this season, you know? In terms of the way he's played, in terms of the volume of scoring has been just outstanding and the value he has to those Warriors. You know, who were without Klay Thompson and they've kind of been ravaged by injury for quite a while. I think James Wiseman's also out with injury right now. That's the number two pick in the draft. And now you're really truly getting to see Steph Curry's ability. I think he put up 49 against the Warriors, 47 against the Celtics. He's put up 40 points a game in the last like 4 to 5 games. And he went through, I think the last week, he made 10 threes in like 10 or more threes in 3 straight games, which is practically unheard of. I mean, Steph Curry is incredible in terms of the way he can shoot the ball, both in terms of volume and efficiency and accuracy and any other kind of metric that you want to use. This is the best shooter we've ever seen from any sport. He can pull up from 35 feet out, no worries, even when he's fully covered. Like, I remember the game against the Sixers, and his brother, Seth Curry, was guarding Steph Curry. Seth Curry isn't a great defender, sure. But Seth Curry was right in his face, like literally covering him, and Ben Simmons was also providing some help. And Steph Curry still pulled up from like 35 feet and made the shot. This guy is just incredible, and I think we've really seen that in the last month. One of the most impressive stretches of offensive firepower, I'd say, in recent memory. The way he's been playing has just been incredible. It's been a privilege to watch more than anything else, because you know you're in the presence of greatness when you watch Steph Curry shoot that ball and just play in general. You know you're in the presence of greatness. And I think that's what we've all been over the past month especially. And look, he's driving up stock for MVP. And I know the Warriors are like the ninth seed right now. I don't even think they have a winning record, but look, without him, they lost by 60 points to the Raptors. Without him, they've been one of the, you know, worst teams in the NBA. They were like the 14 or the 15 seed at some point in time. But then Steph Curry came back and really carried them to, you know, probably making the play-in games. And, you know, let's see what happens. They could go further up the standings as well in a tough Western Conference. And without much support, Steph Curry's practically been doing all this on his own. So I think he's definitely in contention for MVP. And the way he's been playing the past month, if he continues on like this, I wouldn't put it beyond him to win it for the third time in his career. So that's Steph Curry. Now let's talk about the New York Knicks. Now the Knicks have been the laughing stock of the NBA for quite a while. Look, their owner is still kind of a joke. James Dolan is not one of the worst owners in the NBA, if not the worst owner in the NBA, because he's just so soft-skinned, so thin-skulled. He's not willing to kind of accept criticism like an adult. Like, say a fan, he's kicked out fans for holding a poster saying "Fire Dolan" or something like that, or "Sell the team," things of that nature. He's kicked out people like Charles Oakley, who was the heart and soul of the New York Knicks in the 90s. He's kicked him out from Madison Square Garden in the past couple of years, just because he said something that, you know, kind of criticized James Dolan. And then Spike Lee, who's the Knicks' biggest fan for the last 30 years, has been putting the Knicks in his movies forever and gave so much free advertising just because he was a fan of the team. He was being mistreated as well. He was made to, I guess, use like a different entry from the one he was used to using sometime last year. And look, that's an affront to someone of Spike Lee's importance, Spike Lee's gravitas. He doesn't deserve to be treated that way. He deserves to be treated like a superstar because that's exactly what he is. And he's been at the front seat for every front seat courtside for almost every New York Knicks game for the past 25 to 30 years. So he does deserve to be treated like a superstar. He does deserve to be treated differently, you know, because he does give you all that free advertising and he pays for those seats game in and game out for the past 25 to 30 years. So when he's being mistreated, and when Charles Oakley is being mistreated, and when fans are being kicked out for saying things like, you know, fire the owner or sell the team or things like that, that shows you that James Dolan is a joke. Like, that's exactly what he is. He's a joke. And the New York Knicks were kind of the reflection of, James Dolan. You know, in the early 2000s, they had Carmelo. You know, they had a good team. They had a good thing going. They made the playoffs a couple of times. You know, you remember the New York Knicks Miami Heat series. That was a legendary series because you got to see prime Carmelo and LeBron go at it, you know, up against each other. That was obviously amazing to watch. But ever since then, the Knicks have kind of been one of the worst organizations in the NBA. They've run through coach after coach, you know, whether it's Hornacek, Fizdale. You know, they just haven't been able to get it done. But this season, and last season was supposed to be the turning around point. You know, they were supposed to get KD and Kyrie in free agency, get the number one pick, draft Zion Williamson. But none of that happened. They got the number three pick, took RJ Barrett. And then in free agency, they got Julius Randle, who was, I mean, people were making fun of Julius Randle because he was seen as this kind of, you know, stopgap player for the Knicks who were going to continue to be bad. But then this season, something changed. You know, Tom Thibodeau came in as coach. And, you know, we know Tom Thibodeau as this kind of, you know, very, he has a very workhorse-like mentality. He expects his best players to play large minutes, both in the regular season and in the playoffs. Players like, you know, you think about D. Rose, you think about Jimmy Butler, Karl Anthony Towns, Andrew Wiggins, all the players that he's coached, even like when he was an assistant with the Celtics under Doc Rivers, players like KG and Paul Pierce were expected to play long periods of, like, long minutes, even Rondo. So you expected something to come because Tom Thibodeau is a coach that is used to winning. He's not someone that's going to just accept losing or try to tank or make an attempt to fully rebuild the team or anything like that. You know, that's not what you expect from Tom Thibodeau. You expect winning from Tom Thibodeau. Although he tends to look at things from a very short-term perspective. I think of him as kind of, you know, the Jose Mourinho of basketball. There's a very short-term perspective. He tends to overwork his players, sure. Not that his players ever have an issue with him. His players love him. Like, T-Rose loves Tom Thibodeau. But, you know, this season he's really come in and probably done his best coach job. I think he's definitely in contention for coach of the year. And you've seen Julius Randle really elevate and become, he made his first All-Star game. You've seen him elevate and become a superstar in the league, you know. He is in that top 10 MVP conversation for sure. He's putting up great numbers. I think all across the board, not just in like one aspect, whether it's points, rebounds, assists, whatever it is, you know, he's putting up great numbers throughout the board and doing so efficiently. I think his averages for this season are like 24 points, like 11 rebounds and 6 assists. I mean, just think about those numbers. That's like a slightly watered down Nikola Jokic. And even yesterday, he put up 40 points, 11 rebounds and 6 assists against the Atlanta Hawks. So his kind of impact on the team has been immeasurable. He's playing about 37.5 minutes a game, shooting about 46% from the field. And look, he's just elevated the Knicks as a whole, you know, as their new star player. Yeah, he's elevated them as a whole as their new star player. He's done great things for them. He's been a leader, more importantly. And, you know, you look at the players around him. RJ Barrett has taken a step up this season. Players like Derrick Rose, for example, was traded from Detroit to the Knicks. He's been doing a really good job off the bench. So, you know, as a whole, they're the third best defensive team in the league. Mitchell Robinson has been a huge influence at the five. You know, even before this season, Mitchell Robinson is one of the few bright spots because of his effectiveness as, you know, a big man in the end, because he's so good at blocking shots and getting rebounds and playing close to the basket, one of the most efficient close-to-the-basket scorers. I think he leads the league in field goal percentage the last couple of years or something like that. So, you know, they've put this collection of players together that just kind of works. And they're an old school team. They're a team that embodies, you know, what the New York Knicks are about. You know, they play tough nose basketball. They're great on defense. Their inside scoring is very effective. It's where they thrive. It's what they thrive on. And it's why they're winning. They're now on an 8-game win streak. They hold the 4 seed in the Eastern Conference, you know. And as things stand, they would host a playoff series, which is insane to think about. You know, this is the New York Knicks we're talking about. This has been a joke of a franchise for the last few years. So to even not think about them, you know, hosting a playoff series is just incredible. And, you know, it's all because of, you know, people like Tom Thibodeau, Julius Randle, Mitchell Robinson, Derrick Rose, RJ Barrett. And you have to, you know, give some credit to, you know, the upper brass. You know, you had people like William Wesley, who was hired, and Leon Rose, who was hired as kind of, you know, the GM, to play kind of like GM roles and recruiting roles in terms of bringing players into the Knicks and setting up kind of a culture for the franchise. And they've done an excellent job as well. So, you know, as things stand, the Knicks would host the Atlanta Hawks in a playoff series. And I could see them winning that series for sure because, I mean, firstly, they're favored. And secondly, they have home court. I could see them winning that series and easily making the second round. And that's so impossible to think about, you know, the Knicks making the second round of the playoffs. So really, all credit goes to the people that I mentioned before. Now coming to the Celtics, my team. I've been really happy to watch how they've been playing over the last few months. Sorry, last few weeks. You know, we were really on a slide and we weren't playing well at all. You think about people like Jason Tatum wasn't exactly playing at the level that he's used to playing at. And I think we all thought that, you know, it was just a minor slump, but it got to a point where we were unsure whether this team could actually win. Because we did have a losing record for quite a bit of time. I think almost a majority of the season we had a losing record, you know. We were always just, you know, touching 500, just below 500, just above 500. But then we won 6 games straight, and they won 6 easy games either. There were 6 tough games. I thought the Celtics did really, really well to win them. And I think the games that we won were so. Excuse me. So the games that we won weren't even easy games. They were against teams like, obviously, the Knicks. You know, the Knicks being the team that they are right now. Beating the Timberwolves isn't exactly an achievement because, you know, the Timberwolves are the Timberwolves. Then we beat the Nuggets. The Nuggets, obviously, a top 4 seed in the West. Very good team. Beat the Trailblazers. Both of those games away from home, by the way. Both of those great achievements, in my opinion, because, you know, really good teams. Full strength teams who with MVP candidates, and we managed to beat both those teams because of, you know, like Tatum was amazing on this run. He put up 53 on the Celtics. Sorry, he put 53 on the Timberwolves in overtime. And then he hit that clutch three, contested three against the Blazers as well, scored 32 points in that game. And then beat the Lakers away from home, of course. And then we come home, we play the Warriors, and what was, in my opinion, one of the games of the season was. You know, you just had Curry and Tatum just going at it back and forth in what was an incredible game. And the Celtics were down in the fourth quarter. We were down in the second quarter. At any point in the game, it could have gotten away from us completely. But we kept coming back and eventually ended up winning by 5. Tatum was just incredible. I think he scored 44 points in that game. Went toe-to-toe with Steph Curry, which is definitely not easy to do given the level at which Steph is playing right now. Which is otherworldly. So that was one of the games of the season, you know, in terms of just pure shot making in the second half, especially. The first half was good too, but the second half was just insane, especially the fourth quarter. You really saw the kind of superstar that Jason Tatum is. The fact that, you know, he's a top 10, top 15 player in the NBA. Jaylen Brown hasn't been shabby at all too. Jaylen Brown as a second option in this team has been excellent. Kemba Walker's been stepping up his game. And obviously, you know, we lost to the Bulls, I think, a couple of days ago, which was unfortunate, you know. It's a bad way to end such a good run. And the Bulls aren't great, obviously. No offense to anyone who's a Bulls fan. But you could see kind of the signs of things that were missing from that team. That, you know, defensive tenacity, that shot-making ability, the ability to play well in the fourth quarter for Jason Tatum to take over games, ball movement, even player movement. Things like that were happening, and they weren't happening before. So things are looking up for the Celtics. And look, the Celtics are always expected to do really well, especially with the team that they have right now. We expect them to make the conference finals. And they made the conference finals 3 of the last 4 years, but they just haven't been able to get over the hump. But you do suspect they'll be able to do it quite soon. with the kind of talent that they have on the team, especially with someone like Jason Tatum and Jaylen Brown leading the way. So it's an exciting future lies ahead. Let's see what happens the rest of the season. I think it's a very interesting time lies ahead for sure. But now coming to kind of my list of my top five MVP candidates. You know, I kind of went back and forth on this quite a bit. It took me some time to get into it, but I think I finally have my list. It's not too different from most lists, you know, in terms of the five that I have, but I think the order in which I have them is kind of different. So I think my number five player is my number five player on the list is Luka Doncic. And look, Luka's did not have a good start of the season at all. You know, especially at the beginning, the Mavs were not doing well. They were like the 13-14 seed. Things just weren't happening for them. Kristaps Porzingis was out for a long period of time. But I think now with Kristaps coming back, you know, he hasn't been great. But Luka's game has just elevated so much. He's averaging like 28.5 points, 8 rebounds, 8.5 assists a game. He's been incredible this season. Especially, you know, like after the first month, I think he's been especially good. I think he's going to make first team All NBA, All Star starter, of course. And in the near future, he's hit some crazy game winners too. That game winner against the Grizzlies was just absolute madness. I don't know how that went in. One of the craziest game winners I've seen. He's clutch. And I think he has that ability to carry a team in the long run. So that's Luka. Luka's number five for me. He's going to be the best player in the NBA very soon. Well, whenever LeBron chooses to retire or drops off, which is unlikely. So whenever LeBron chooses to retire, I think Luka will take over that mantle as the best player in the league, purely because of his all-round ability. And if he can improve his shot and the kind of defense that he plays, I mean, the sky's the limit for this dude. Number four on my list, I have Giannis Antetokounmpo. Look, I didn't put Steph Curry on this list purely because I think the Warriors are the ninth seed right now. I just cannot, in good conscience, put him on this list. Luka just made it above him barely because the Mavs are in a better position. And Luka's stats, you know, are similar to Steph's. I think Steph's averaging like 31 points and 5 assists. Luka's averaging 28 points, 8 rebounds, 8 assists. So in terms of an all-around game, I think Luka's been better. So that's why I put him above Steph. But again, number four on my list is Giannis. Giannis has been dominant as usual. Draining defensive player of the year and MVP, two-time MVP. He retires right now. He's a Hall of Famer, you know, in terms of the career he's had. Obviously, he needs to overcome that hump in the playoffs, but he has quite a while to do that. And, you know, he's just getting started. I think Giannis has a legendary career in front of him. I mean, look, again, as I said, he retires today. He's a Hall of Famer as a two-time MVP and defensive player of the year. But I think he still has a long career ahead of him. And I think he's going to be one of the greatest players of all time. And look, getting over the playoff hump is something that he needs to do, for sure. But if you look at his regular season stats this year again, just incredible. 28.5 points, 11 rebounds, 6 assists, about a steal and a block each. And the Bucks are the 3 seed, of course. Maybe not as good as they expected to be in the regular season, but look. The regular season shouldn't matter for the Bucks anymore. The way to get it done in the postseason. Last year, the Bucks offense was one of the best offense in NBA history. You know, they were on course to win like 67, 68 games. But look, all that doesn't matter. They need to find a way to win in the playoffs, and Giannis needs to kind of lead that effort. And my number three, I have Damian Lillard. Actually, no, I have Joel Embiid at number three, and I have Dame at number two. I have Joel Embiid at number three. Joel Embiid, I think, would easily be winning MVP if he wasn't injured for that period of time for which he was injured. Because, you know, look at his numbers, 30 points, 11 rebounds, 3 assists, block and a half, and, you know, he's shooting 40%, more than 40% from three, I think close to 50% from the field. Good, very good free throw shooter. The best, in my opinion, one of the two best centers in the league. And again, on course to just have a legendary career if he just keeps continuing on the course that he's on right now. And look, the Sixers are the one seed in the East. And I wish I could put Embiid at the top of the list because, you know, I hate Philly. Sorry, not Philly, the city, but the 76ers. I don't like the Philadelphia 76ers, but I love Joel Embiid. And I think he's been so impactful. I think Doc Rivers. I think I've made my feelings pretty clear on Doc Rivers. I think he's an overrated coach for sure. But I think he's done a good job with Embiid in kind of making his game evolve so that he steps inside and plays in the post more than he did last season, playing more aggressive, and I think that's really helped him because the guy's got all the moves in the book. His post moves are just incredible, best post moves for any player in the league. So he just needs to find a way to harness that talent, and he's done that this season. It's kind of unfortunate that he couldn't stay on the court for an extended period of time. I think like 3 weeks he was out. So yeah, I mean, look, I think he's number three on my list. Number two on my list is still Dame Lillard, and I'm gonna admit that there is a bit of bias here. He's my favorite player in the league. I think on a more unbiased list, he should probably be in the 3, 4 to 5 range, maybe, because you know he's out right now, and his team hasn't been winning as of late as much as they were. And he went on this crazy stretch in like I think in February and March into March as well. But this year, yeah, I don't think this month I don't think he's been as great. But you know, still look at his numbers like 29 points, 8 assists, 4 rebounds, leading just like the most loyal player in the league, the most clutch player in the league. And I think, look, realistically speaking, I'd put him third or fourth, but I'm going to put him second because he's my guy. I love Dame Lillard. And I think if he finds a way for the Warriors to, for the sorry, for the Trailblazers to come back on the winning note that they were earlier in the season, I think he can definitely move up this list. I'll move up the actual list into, you know, that number two, number three, and you know, seriously contend for MVP if they do go on a winning run towards the end of the season. And number one on my list is quite obvious, Nikola Jokic. Just look at the numbers: 26 points, 11 rebounds, 9 assists, steal in half a game. You know, a couple of games ago, he put up like 45 points, 15 rebounds, and 7 assists, something of that ilk, and those numbers have kind of just become standard for Jokic. You know, he came into the season, you know, more in shape than he was before. Defensively, he's been looking better. Obviously, offensively, he's an absolute joke offensively. Like his ability is second to none in terms of playing center. His ability to pass, to shoot, to play inside, and to rebound even. Look, I think he's the front runner for MVP right now. The Nuggets are the 4 seed, even without Jamal Murray, who's probably out for the season with an ACL tear. So, you know, Jokic is outstanding, just an outstanding player. One of the most, like, I guess, likable players in the league as well, and that adds to his appeal. And I think he's definitely on track to win MVP this season. So that's NBA talk done for today. And I think I don't know if I'm gonna be able to get to baseball this week right now. But I think one thing I really do want to talk about, because I do believe it is so important, is the European Super League, or ESL. So essentially, the proposal four to 5 days ago, 12 teams had signed on. I'm going to name those teams: six English teams, the Big Six, Liverpool, Manchester United, Manchester City, Chelsea, Arsenal, and Spurs, Tottenham Hotspurs. Then from Spain, you had Real Madrid, Barcelona, and Atletico Madrid, and then from Italy you had Inter Milan, AC Milan, and Juventus. Those were your 12 teams. Apparently, PSG and Bayern Munich were also thinking about signing on to the ESL. And then there were some spots for like, you know, five more teams that would kind of rotate every season. There are 15 founding members; those would stay intact throughout, and there are five rotating members that would just, you know, go come in and out occasionally. So that's kind of the plan behind the ESL, and originally it was planned to be kind of this midweek tournament as a replacement for the Champions League almost, because for these big clubs, the revenue from the Champions League wasn't helping them out to the extent that they wanted it to help them out. So they're just trying to tear up the whole football, the way football is structured. Association football, of course. I'm going to be saying football. Please excuse my language. They were essentially trying to change the way football is structured, and let me tell you why that's such a big problem. Because look, this European Super League was going to be these best teams playing against each other, with no opportunity for teams like, you know, if you think of in England, teams like West Ham, Leicester City, the Wolves, Everton, teams like this who are competing for Champions League spots right now. and right now are doing better than a team like Arsenal. Arsenal is 11th in the Premier League right now. Spurs are 7th or 8th in the Premier League right now. These teams are doing better than them, Leicester City and West Ham, but they're not going to have a chance to reap those profits just because they're not a part of the traditional big six. So essentially, they're just creating this almost like this cartel where it's this small group of clubs that are just going to be making the most money year in and year out, almost $300 to $400 million more than most other clubs. And look, football in terms of the leagues, it's not exactly designed for parity. You're always going to have your Manchester Uniteds, your Manchester Cities, your Liverpool. These teams are just, they're more financially secure than a team like, say, Southampton or Burnley, for example. And so they're going to be better. They're going to be able to buy better players. But there is still some sense of equality in the way competitiveness works. You're not there is no like closed group of clubs. Promotion and relegation from the top division and the second division exist in every country. The worst clubs go down to the second division. The best clubs from the second division come up to the first division for the next season. You think about going to the Champions League or going to the Europa League, which is essentially like a second-rate Champions League, but it's still amongst the best teams in Europe playing. You have the top four in England who go to the Champions League, but now that wouldn't happen with the European Super League because it's going to be those same six teams playing in the European Super League year in and year out, regardless of how they're doing in terms of performance in the league. And that's why fans are so against it. These people were just trying to make this kind of create this cartel out of football. And football is a sport which was run by the fans, it was created for the fans, it's created by the working class community, like most sports, but it's been kind of just taken by these rich businessmen. You think about the owners of the top six Premier League clubs. You think about Liverpool's owner. Liverpool's owners, the Fenway Sports Group, also own the Red Sox. Manchester United's owner are the Glazer family, who also own the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Stan Kroenke owns Arsenal, and he also owns, the Denver Broncos. He also owns the LA Rams. He also owns the Colorado Avalanche. Yeah. Look, Man City is owned by Sheikh Mansour from Abu Dhabi. Chelsea is owned by Roman Abramovich, who's this Russian oligarch. Spurs is also run by an American. It's essentially become this boys' club of non-Englishmen, non-supporters of the clubs, who've essentially come in and tried to make profit-earning organizations as opposed to teams that win, teams that are connected to the communities, which is what football is supposed to be, which is what football has been for such a long period of time. And that is why fans have such a huge problem with it, because they're going to be taking the game further away from the kind of competitiveness that we enjoy. You see, you think of a team like Stoke City, for example. Stoke City or Fulham or Aston Villa. They have players who've been dreaming to play at the likes of an Old Trafford or at the likes of an Anfield. They've been wanting to play at these stadiums. These players have been wanting to play at these stadiums for their entire life. It's their childhood dreams. And with a league like the European Super League and these European Super League teams not being able to play in domestic leagues anymore, which is what the rule was going to be, which is what the Premier League was going to do. If the European League Super League did go through, they were going to ban the teams from playing in their leagues, in their domestic leagues. Barcelona couldn't play in La Liga anymore. AC Milan couldn't play in Serie A. Manchester City, United, Arsenal couldn't play in the Premier League anymore. The dreams of these kids, they go away, and also the league loses so much revenue. So in terms of TV revenue, because the top six teams like United, teams like Liverpool, bring in such a large portion of revenue, because they're watched worldwide, they're supported worldwide, and then that revenue is then divided and provided to the other teams in the league, not just these top six, and also some portion of it goes down to the second division, to the teams in the second division. So it's kind of the structure that supports the whole football pyramid in England, which is going to be broken apart because of this European Super League and because of the pure greed for money that these owners of these teams have. And sure, I understand that the teams are struggling financially because of the whole pandemic, fans not being in the stands, things of that nature, And that's sad, I agree. Like, you do need to be able to recoup some of that money financially speaking. But this is not the way to go about it. You can't just be trying to steal football from the people to whom it matters the most, just so you can recoup profit. And that's where the issue with the ESL lies. That's why teams, fans of teams both in the European Super League and fans of teams who aren't in the European Super League and teams who aren't in the European Super League have such a major problem with this cartel, this boys club being created, where all the profits which is going to go to these 12 teams will just be divided amongst them equally. And these 12 teams were only going to face each other and not face any other team. You know, that's why the European Super League faced so much criticism. That's why it was hated so much by the fans. That's why, you know, me as a fan, I'm so happy that, you know, it was that my team pulled out of the league, that all the English teams pulled out of the league, and now we can go back to playing football the way it was meant to be played. You know, those 2 days were traumatic for football fans, because that's just not the way that we want the game to work. That's not the way the game works. And I think these owners need to realize that. And if they don't realize that, they need to sell the team. These owners need to be fans of the club before they're just, you know, just their financial caretakers, you know. You think about someone like Joel Glazer, who's the owner of Manchester United. He doesn't even understand what the offside rule is. And the offside rule is one of the most basic rules in football. And apparently, it's been rumored that one of the owners of the 6 teams showed up to a game of their team and couldn't even recognize which color kit they were playing and what color was their shirt. And that's how disconnected they are with the actual operations of the football team, not just the business operations. So that's really sad, and that's why I think the owners either need to come to terms with the fact that they're running football clubs, not businesses, or just sell the team, because they're not going to receive the support of the fans. Without the support of the fans in football, you cannot do anything. You cannot do anything without the support of the fans in association football. So I think that's kind of the frustration that not just me, but all fans around the world had with the European Super League. You know, it was just this taking away the root of sport. Sport is rooted in competitiveness, in equality. It's the great equalizer. Sport is a great equalizer. You know, poor, rich, they're not being differentiated by socioeconomic status. They can only be differentiated by their ability to perform on the biggest stage. And that would have been changed if this European Super League had been formed. And thankfully, it wasn't. So, you know, that's where Tuesday was a day of great joy for me when I realized that the league wasn't going to be formed. So that's football talk, association football talk, because, you know, I felt it was really necessary to talk about my feelings regarding this. I don't usually talk about football, but in this situation, I think it was 100% warranted. But now moving to the football, which all of you must be more familiar with, which is the NFL. And there's been so much focus on the quarterbacks in this year's drafts, you know. Trevor Lawrence, Mac Jones, Justin Fields, Zach Wilson, Trey Lance. You know, these 5 quarterbacks' names have been just circulating throughout. And obviously, you have people like Kyle Trask and Kellen Mond, of course, who were slated to go later in the draft, but still be, you know, who could still turn into stars, you know. They're more developmental projects, but they could turn into something big in the years to come. And essentially, I think a lot of time has been spent in talking about these quarterbacks by mainstream media in general, and on my part also, of course. So today I wanted to take time to rank my top 8 non-quarterback prospects in this year's NFL draft. And I'm going to go in order. I'm going to start at 8. And at 8 I have Patrick Surtain. Patrick Surtain, of course, cornerback from the University of Alabama, probably the best cornerback in this year's draft. I think most people project a team like the Dallas Cowboys to take him because they're in such need of secondary help. And I think he is definitely an elite corner. You know, he has the opportunity to come in and be impactful right away. And look, wide receivers in the NFL are very different from college football in terms of their quality, speed, strength, route running ability. But Patrick Surtain I think he definitely has the capability to keep up with these NFL players. And, you know, it's in his blood because his dad was also a football player who played for the Dolphins, I believe. But, you know, this kid really does have it. He was the SEC Defensive Player of the Year this year. He was an All-American, first-team All-SEC. National champion, of course. And in terms of physical, he's a big corner. He's 6'2", 200 pounds. So he really, and he was a defensive MVP of the Rose Bowl last year. So, you know, he definitely has the capability to transition to that highest level of football. And I think that he's very underrated in terms of what he can do on the field. And he's gonna make a team. He's gonna make some team really, really happy. And according to me, I think his best landing spot is the Dallas Cowboys. Number seven on my list is Micah Parsons, who's the linebacker. He was a linebacker out of Penn State, I believe. And look, this is not a very deep linebacker draft, but I think Micah Parsons is definitely the cream of the crop by far. You know, you look at his speed, his strength, his physical capability. You know, again, he won the Linebacker of the Year award a couple years ago. He was an All-American. He's 6'3", 245 pounds. I think he ran like a 4.3 and a 4.340 or a 4.440, something like that, which is just insane. He opted out of the 2020 season because of the whole COVID pandemic, so we didn't get to see him, you know, at his, you know, perform this year. But in 2019, he was just incredible. The last time we saw him on the field, at his pro day, he ran like a 4.340, which is at his size is incredible. And I know you can't really take these pro day stocks into account when you're trying to consider, you know, where you can draft them. But Micah Parsons is a great tackler, very intelligent, and he can bring a lot to a team. And I think a team like, you know, a team like, for example, the Falcons, I think could definitely use him because they have Deion Jones at linebacker, but they don't seem to have much around him. And someone like Micah Parsons can play, you know, he can play inside linebacker in a 3-4. He can even play outside linebacker in a 4-3. So I think he's quite adaptable, and I think he'd be great for a team like the Falcons, who do need defensive help desperately. And I think he'd be a great fit. Number six on my list I have, and well, this is a bit controversial, but Rashawn Slater. Rashawn Slater, of course, tackle from Northwestern. Again, I don't think he played last season, but this guy, he's an absolute stud. Firstly, he's very technically gifted in terms of the way he plays tackle. He uses his hands and his feet really well. His footwork is impeccable. He's a big boy. 6'3", 315 pounds. Again, look, I think he just has it. You know, this guy is going to go. This guy's going to go quite early in the draft. Probably going to be the second tackle taken. I think a team like the Chargers would definitely be a great fit for Micah Parsons. You know, they have Brian Bulaga to play right tackle, of course, and then they have, I believe they got Matt Filer and Corey Linsley, who are interior offensive linemen, as they're trying to, you know, rebuild their line in front of a elite young quarterback like Justin Herbert. I think Rashawn Slater would be a great fit for the Chargers, and I do think that's where he's going to end up going, because I don't think most teams in front of that have an immediate need for an offensive tackle, except the Bengals. But I do believe the Bengals will take Penei Sewell. So let's see. But I think the Chargers are probably really good for Rashawn Slater. Then at number five, I have Devontae Smith. Devontae Smith, of course, Heisman winner from the University of Alabama. One of the few wide receivers to win the award. National champion. He had an insane season last year. He was just incredible for Alabama. He had, I think, 1,800 yards and like 23 touchdowns, which is just incredible. First wide receiver to win the award in 30 years. Won two college national championships. The kid is just incredible. Really good route runner. Really fast. I think the knock on him by a lot of people is that he's very light. He's like 6'1", but he came in at only 160 pounds. 166 pounds, I think, in his last weigh-in. So that's a concern for some teams because, you know, he's going to be up against linebackers and receivers, linebackers and corners who are way bigger than him. So that is a concern for some teams. But I think he's definitely going to be a stud in the league. His route running ability is, in this draft, is probably either 1A or 1B, you know, along with Ja'Marr Chase, who I'll get to in a bit. So I think this guy has really got it. You know, he's got it. He's got the it factor. He's amazing. He doesn't, his mentality, you know, he's got the warrior mentality. He's got that dog in him. So you know he's going to be a competitive, he's going to be a competitive jerk, that's for sure. And I think of a team like the New England Patriots, you know, who need the number one wide receiver now that Julian Edelman's gone. Of course, they did get Nelson Aguilar and Kendrick Bourne in free agency. But I think they're still in need of a true number one wide receiver. And I think someone like DeVonta Smith, who in case he does fall to them, would be an excellent pickup for them. Even though he's kind of, there are some concerns regarding that. I don't think that takes away from his. I don't think that should take away from his draft stock. I think he's still going to be an incredible player in the NFL. The number four on my list, I have Jaylen Waddle, also from Alabama. A lot of comparisons to Tyreek Hill from when it comes to Jaylen Waddle, played alongside DeVonta Smith, and was, you know, seen as the better receiver of the two until you know, Smith's kind of insane last season. You know, he's a bit shorter than DeVonta. He's like 5'10" and he's 185 pounds around. But his speed is just incredible. He's probably the fastest player in this year's draft. A lot of Tyreek Hill comparisons. Very versatile. He can play in the slot. He could play outside. Again, a team like the Giants, I think, he'd be a great pickup for the Giants, who do need that true deep threat. I think the Giants have really good receiving core now because they have, you know, your Kenny Golladay, Sterling Shepard, Darius Slayton, John Ross, Evan Ingram at tight end. But I think that Jaylen Waddle would be a great pickup as a versatile weapon for them, both in the slot. He can play as an X, Y, and Z receiver. He can play all across the board. So I think he's a very versatile piece, very versatile offensive weapon. I think Jaylen Waddle is going to go very high up in the draft. And I do think he's the fourth best non-quarterback prospect for me. At number three, I have Ja'Marr Chase, best wide receiver in this draft by quite a wide margin. The last time, you know, we saw him play with kind of an elite quarterback. We saw him do what he did with Joe Burrow. You know, he as a sophomore, he led the FBS in receiving yards and touchdowns, and won the Biletnikoff Award for the country's best wide receiver, All-American, first team All-SEC, national champion. You know, just the awards just come streaming down. You know, he was just incredible. He had like 1,800 yards and 20 touchdowns the last time we saw him play. Speed, route running, hands, physicality, dude's got it all, you know. He's a big receiver. He's like 210 pounds, 6 feet. Not big in terms of his height, but he's a very strong receiver. He's going to be able to body up cornerbacks, you know, and go up and catch up contested ball. He has the ability to do that as well. We saw that with him in the 2019 offense with LSU. You know, he's just different, and I think he is definitely the best wide receiver in this year's draft. Number two on my list, I have offensive lineman from the University of Oregon, Penei Sewell. I think Penei Sewell needs to go to the Bengals. I really hope the Bengals draft him because they need help with Joe Burrow. You know, you had these new pictures coming out of Joe Burrow in the new Bengals uniforms. And you could see a huge mark down his knee where he had to get surgery on his ACL, MCL, and PCL. I think he had tears in all three ligaments. He needs protection. Look, I think if the Bengals already have decent weapons, then you can always get a wide receiver in the second round. Someone like an Amari Rodgers or Rashad Bateman is going to be waiting for you later on in the draft. You know, maybe Rashad Bateman doesn't make it in the second round, but you're still going to have some really good wide receivers waiting there for you. But you're not going to have a generational offensive lineman prospect like Penei Sewell waiting there for you. Penei Sewell is huge. I don't think he played last season because I believe, if I'm not wrong, the Pac-12 suspended football operations or something of that sort. Or no, I think he just opted out of his junior season. But look, 6'6", 330 pounds, you know, just absolute meat and potatoes. He has a different level of physicality, you know, on his side. And in terms of just raw physical talent, I think he's the definitely by far the best tackle in this draft. His game can, you know, really, he can refine his game as time progresses, and I think he will end up doing that. And I do think the Bengals, I really hope they don't overcomplicate it, and I hope they do end up taking him with the number 5 pick. And that leads me to the number 1 non-quarterback prospect in this year's draft. No prizes for guessing. It is Kyle Pitts, tight end out of Florida. Probably the best tight end prospect to come into this league in the last 15 to 20 years. People are saying that he should just be used as a wide receiver. Like, you know, forget tight ends. Because he's just different. He's 6'6", 240 pounds. But he ran a 4.45 40 at his pro day with Florida, you know. And look, he had like 12 touchdowns this season. In 8 games played, he had 12 touchdowns. I mean, like 800 yards, 8 games and 12 touchdowns on like 45 receptions. Like, he's a good deep threat. Like, he's 6'6" and he's still a deep threat. And he has route running ability. He has finesse in the way he runs routes. He's not just a powerful player. He's obviously powerful at 6'6" and 245. And his body looks like it's been sculpted by an architect, you know. He's so strong. He's so physical, but he's also intelligent in the way that he runs routes. I think teams should just consider him as a wide receiver. You know, forget tight end. I think they should just consider him as a wide receiver because his receiving ability is just different. And I think he'd be wasted putting in to inline block. You know, someone like Travis Kelce and George Kittle, I understand them blocking because, especially for George Kittle, that's his primary talent. He's got the blocking abilities of an offensive lineman. But Kyle Pitts has the receiving abilities of an elite wide receiver, and that shouldn't be wasted. You know, I think he should just be used as a slot wide receiver or even outside. And that's my opinion. And for me, he is the number 1 non-quarterback prospect in this draft. And look, I think he'd be a good fit for any team. So I'm not really going to put any limits on where he should end up going. I'm just going to say that he'd be a great fit for whichever team picks him because he's got different ability. So those are my top 8 non-quarterback prospects in this draft. My time's running out, so thank you so much for joining me today on the rundown. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you about, you know, about football, about association football, American football, both types. Talk about basketball for a bit. I'm sorry I couldn't get to baseball, but I will be talking about baseball in the future for sure. Next week, I'll probably just going to be doing a full mock draft of the first round, which is going to be kind of hard. It's kind of unfamiliar territory for me, but I'm still looking forward to it. You know, I can't wait to get to it. So anyway, thank you so much for joining me. This has been the rundown. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I will catch you guys later. Thank you so much.